Through Princess Diana, the world was able to get a glimpse of the difficulty of becoming a member of the royal family. But in some ways, being a part of England's monarchy pales in comparison to the demands and restrictions of the Japanese imperial family. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today we're going to imagine living in one of the longest-running, most secretive monarchies in the world, as we go between the lines of The Commoner, a story of the first commoner to marry into the imperial family of Japan. It's written by award-winning author John Burnham Schwartz. John's previous novels, including Bicycle Days and Reservation Road, have been translated into 15 languages, with Reservation Road even being adopted into a film. Welcome, John. Thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
The Commoner is a fascinating story, and it's based loosely, I understand, on the life of the current Empress of Japan. But before we go into that story, could you give us just a brief history of the Japanese imperial family so we can have a background?
I'll try and keep it brief. It goes back a long way.
Right.
And obviously, having done all the research for this book, I know more than I need to know. But yeah, it's quite an extraordinary institution. In fact, I don't think that there's any family that comes close to it in terms of its longevity, its mysterious qualities, the degree to which it is sheltered in all human ways from the public. I mean, really, it's a family that is made up entirely of symbols. Its entire reason for being is a symbolic one and not, in some sense, a human one.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes back. It traces its lineage back directly through the male line, of course, all the way back to the beginning of recorded history in Japan, which is almost 1,600 years. And it actually, beyond that, beyond recorded history, it enters the arena of myth.
Yes.
And it goes all the way back in the mind of the culture to the beginnings of the earth, the rising of the sun goddess,
right,
Amaterasu Omikami, out of this sort of atmosphere, and eventually from her came the first emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually led around the 9th or 10th, 11th century to the world that we know from the Tale of Genji, which is the first novel really ever written, and was by Murasaki Shikibu. It's a very, very long novel, not to everybody's taste, but it's a story of the court world back then in Kyoto, which is where the court was.
Mm-hmm.
And we know a few hundred years later from, among other documents, a book called The Confessions of Lady Nijo, which is a book written by a woman who was a courtesan to a number of emperors and who eventually ended up being exiled and ended her days as a nun, a wandering nun. About 500 years after that, in the late 19th century, 1869, as Japan reopened to the West, a small group of advisors around Emperor Meiji decided that it was time that the emperor become something more than simply a symbol of cultural and even racial purity for the country, that he be something more akin to the emperor who came from the goddess. And they wrote a constitution and in which the emperor ceased to become a man and he became, in fact, a deity. The way that they worked that really was to meld the office of the emperor and the being of the emperor with the indigenous religion of Shinto. They made Shinto a state religion as opposed to simply another religion among any number.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things to keep in mind is that in the early part of Japan's history, they came rather late to the game in some way, and they borrowed very heavily, especially from China, from India and from Korea as well. This is not something that is often discussed in Japan. I think especially the borrowing from the Koreans
right,
probably doesn't go over too well. But in fact, the Shinto and the imperial family as a whole, these are the sort of indigenous institutions of the country and of the culture. And I think that some of the people always ask, well, why does this family still exist? Because how can they still exist and what is the reason for it? And the truth is, I think that a lot of it has to do with some unarticulated sense of identity of the Japanese about their own culture in the midst of where they came from and the heavy borrowing that went on. At any rate, the emperor then is raised up to become something of a god. Now, when we think of the Japanese in the late 19th century and into the first half of the 20th century, We often think about them here in the West. We often think about them being at war.
Right.
They were often at war.
The kamikazes.
Right.
And they're not.
Mm-hmm. They were being at war and not fighting for, let's say, a president,
right,
but fighting for something much larger. They're fighting for the emperor, and the emperor is not a man. He is a god. And they did fight. They fought the Chinese. They fought the Russians.
Everybody.
They fought the Koreans. They fought the Chinese again. And eventually they fought World War II, which was the first battle that they lost.
That they lost, right.
And in 1946, in January of 46, when the emperor gets on the radio at MacArthur's demand, and he gets on the radio and he is forced to say, they've already surrendered a few months before.
Japan has. Mm-hmm.
Yes. He's forced to say that he is not, in fact, a god, but he is a man. Had you been in Japan at that time, and I've spoken to a couple who were, you would have seen all across the country people falling to their knees.
Ooh, the shock of it.
Because they've never heard his voice before. In fact, many of them didn't even know that he had a voice in the sense that we have a voice. And in fact, the language that he spoke was a convoluted court Japanese, which wasn't even particularly comprehensible to many people. It was very strange. And
wow.
When, in the succeeding years, he was sent out across the country by MacArthur and the occupation forces in order to get to know the people, you had these situations in which he would go out into the world, and oftentimes you'd find that he didn't even know the names for many common objects because he had never been out
and
in the
world. Exposed to it, really. Yeah.
How this connects with the current empress and the current crown princess. Well, that man in 1946 who got on the radio to say that he was not a god but a man, that was Hirohito. Hirohito was the emperor who saw, you know, through the 20s and 30s and 40s, through the war. There's still argument about what degree he knew of what was going on in the war and to what degree
he was behind
it. In terms
of the attack on Pearl
Yes.
Harbor and so forth.
And the many things. There's mm-hmm. still, in academic circles, still a great debate going on about that, although clearly he knew more than it was once said that he did. But that man, we forget, he didn't die until 1989, 19 years ago. And he lived all that time, and he was emperor all that time until he died. That man was the current empress, Michiko Shoda's father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things that we think of as being
the
completely
past,
in the past,
right.
They're
mm-hmm.
not so in the past. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that is because nothing really has changed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that's the sort of historical.
Good. You talk about how secretive the family is and the rituals even and mm-hmm. so forth. If they were, how did you find out about these rituals and things?
Well, that is a good question. One of the things to point out, and it's really, really hard to fully grasp this in the age of YouTube, to even believe that it's possible. You know, I mean, you or I do something, it's on some video somewhere tomorrow.
Right.
And usually not particularly flattering, I think it's safe to say. This is a family. The people who are inside this family, nothing is ever going to get out. Nothing that marks them as an individual human being. No fragments of letters that they've ever written. No letters. Not only no letters that they wrote, but no letters that have been received by others ever. You know, I mean, we live in an age where if you send somebody a letter, and if any news about you ever comes to light, no matter who you are, some person who received a letter from you is going to put it forward.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to it will be published somewhere. That has never happened. Mm-hmm. Never happened in Japan. Never will happen in Japan.
I wonder how they can exercise such control.
It's a group mindset of control, and it begins. You cannot have access. First of all, the laws about everyone who lives in the family go back 1,600 years, and they cannot be broken. I mean, this is a story of people from outside who came in. And in fact, however dynamic they were before they arrived, they were brought into line and essentially crushed by the sheer weight of history that fell on their shoulders. They were crushed and flattened as they were meant to be flattened into symbols. If you're three-dimensional, you cannot be a symbol. You must be flattened. And they get flattened by all of the laws that constrain every single thing that they do.
And that is to make them respect the emperor more, or?
Yes, because the institution simply could not exist if these were humans with
right,
infallible
with human
humans.
Need. Right,
they're,
right.
They are
right,
meant
right,
to symbolize
right, right,
the continuity.
And so the emperor doesn't even think of them as human beings, huh? He thinks of them, what, as property almost?
No one
maybe?
Will know. I mean, this is the thing. Yeah. If we ever talk about what someone thinks, we'll never know.
That's right.
It's never been, you know, there aren't even any unofficial photographs. There aren't any unofficial off-the-cuff interviews. Every press conference that's given by the imperial family, the questions are vetted weeks in advance.
Pre-screened,
and the answers, 99 times out of 100, are written for the imperial family members by the Imperial Household Agency, which is a group of about 1,100 bureaucrats who dictate, you know, what every single member of the family says, does, and wears at any particular moment.
All right. So we're going to come now to the young lady in the story, the first commoner. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Haruko, and then I want you to talk about how she basically traded her freedom for rituals.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it would be silly to talk about Haruko's history without also talking about the actual empress's history because, I mean, the book is transparently inspired by the lives of two actual figures. One is the current empress of Japan, Michiko Shoda, who in 1959, she was born into a privileged but a normal family. Like us, had parents, went to school, had friends.
This is in Japan?
Yes, in Japan. She was born in 1934, made mistakes, had jokes, all sorts of things that she did. In 1959, after meeting the crown prince a couple of years before that on a tennis court, I think they did fall in love. It's generally considered that it was actually a love match. He proposed to her. She and her family rejected him at first, feeling she said that she was unworthy. But there were many, many pressures upon her, and the family I know was extremely concerned about what this would mean.
Her father, right? He didn't particularly care. Well, in the book, anyway.
Yes.
Right.
And again, some of that is imagined, but it's all basically taken from sources that suggested that this is the way it was. She crossed over. There was an enormous celebration. Of course, the wedding ceremony was done exactly as it had been done for centuries. She wore the same garments that had been worn. Everything was done exactly that way. She had been trained in the ways of the palace, but basically still knew nothing. She crosses over the moat into the palace and basically disappears as a human
And they
being.
Really do have a moat around
Yes, they do. They
the
have
palace.
240
so
acres.
So it's more than just a figurative speech. She really did cross the moat.
You cross the moat
into
and
a different
through
world.
The gates and into the palace. And she had a boy a year or two later, quite quickly. And you can say that's all she was really supposed to do. That was her duty. That's all they're ever supposed to do.
Right. But she was shocked, though, by – I know she probably expected, you know, some restrictions and some even control. But I think she was really shocked with the degree that she did reach, especially as a matter of fact, I mentioned rituals. There's a section in the book that talks about her. I think it might be the day after she got married. And she why don't you read that for us?
Okay. And so life became a series of rituals written in another age. And rituals became life. A month passed, then two. Every day, without fail, I entered a room too quickly, spoke too often or too loudly, waved my hands in a coarse fashion, scratched an itch, offered an opinion, bowed to an angle of less than 60 degrees before my parents-in-law, and so forth. Some of these gaffes of courtly etiquette were due to nerves, some to ignorance, others to innocence, still others to experience of a kind that no longer counted for anything. Whenever possible, my husband attempted to counsel me on how to improve myself and the process to shore up my depressed spirits. But his responsibilities lay elsewhere, and I had handlers enough to educate me. They were women, my ladies-in-waiting, Mrs. Oshima chief among them, who in all cases and at all times spoke on Her Majesty's behalf. In their strict adherence to a long-established body of rules and a willingness to punish the smallest signs of lax discipline, they were like the nuns who had taught me in school, though the soil in which this higher calling was planted was too thin to sustain even a trace of the nuns' compassion. It took me some time to register this crucial difference. I was, at first, under the illusion that my mistakes would be viewed as temporary surface flaws, nicks and scratches easily healed. But as the weeks passed and the harsh judgments poured in, always in private, in the coded language of feminine court disapproval that was to be my new mother tongue, I was gradually disabused of my naivete and made to understand that in a world constituted entirely of surface, all flaws run deep.
Well, if you've just tuned in, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines of The Commoner by John Burnham Schwartz. She was terrorized by her mother-in-law, too.
She was, and I think this is one of the, you know, the aspects of that history that has kind of seeped out, largely because the then crown princess, now the empress, suffered a nervous breakdown. And this is echoed.
This was after the baby,
a
few months after the baby was
born.
Thank God she had a son.
Yes. Then we get to the crown princess now, who has not had a son and has suffered a series of nervous breakdowns. The empress, the crown princess back then in 1961, she suffered a breakdown and lost her voice entirely for 7 months. She recovered her voice eventually, had more children. And in whatever way, some degree that we'll never know, she found some relationship with her condition. 30 years later, her son falls madly in love with the most dynamic career woman of his generation, Masako Owada, who in fact was 2 years ahead of me at Harvard.
Mm.
I never knew her. She had grown up all over the world, spoke 5 or 6 languages.
Right.
Her father was a very prominent diplomat. The crown prince proposed to her. She rejected him. She rejected him 2 more times after that in the succeeding years. Imagine
3 times.
Three times. Imagine the strength required to do that for her. And finally, he told his parents and the Imperial Household Agency authorities that if he could not marry her, he would marry no one, thus ending 1,600 years through the male line of the imperial dynasty. At any rate, we don't know exactly what it was that was the final straw that coerced her into accepting him, but she did.
Mm-hmm.
She married him in 1993, did not get pregnant until 2001, most certainly through in vitro, fertility drugs, and which was not written about in Japan. Gave birth to a girl, not a boy, as she was supposed to, and basically from that moment on in 2001 has suffered one kind of breakdown or another and has hardly been seen in public in almost 4 years. And at the age of 44, I think it's safe to say her life seems to most people as though it were over.
Oh, fascinating tale of the imperial family. Now, we were just talking about the pressures on both the empress and the princess and their mental illness as a result of it. Compare this to Princess Diana. I mean, now this is really making her story even more credible.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the differences maybe can be summed up sort of metaphorically. When I think of the empress, when I think of Haruko, the narrator of this book, let's say, or the real empress, really. I mean, in this, they are very much bound together. I think that I picture her getting married at the age of 24, not having lived a normal life up till then, not having known that she was going to cross over. And I picture her, it's as though, you know, she were walking along and suddenly she fell down a well about 5,000 feet deep.
Mm.
At the bottom of that well is a sort of mini civilization, a world within a world, all laid out, all the rules already spoken for, all the words already spoken for. Every word you're ever going to say is not going to be yours. Every action that you're ever going to take is not going to be yours. And if it is yours, you will be crushed because they will crush it out of you in a sense. Meanwhile, up on the surface, it's not as though you're in a well because your image is still being beamed. It's your holograph. They take you and they put you down there, but they beam your image up to the surface. And you're still speaking. You can see yourself up there. You're saying words, but they're not your words. You're making actions, but they're not your actions. They're words and actions that belong to people from 1,000 years ago.
Mm.
Nothing to do with you as a human being. All right, so that's the Japanese situation. And it goes on and on and on. The situation, as I take it, in Britain with the House of Windsor, let's say, with Princess Di. And I have to qualify this by saying that I've never been a big royal watcher. It's just, you know, it wasn't what drew me to the story.
Right.
But I never got the feeling that Princess Diana fell down a well 5,000 feet deep. We never lost sight of her entirely. Now, this was one of the reasons why there's so much greater sympathy in some regard for her, because she was in her finest moments. Even if it was just projected by us, she was kind of like us. Now, the problem is with the Japanese, with the crown, the empress and the crown princess, what really kills them is and is sort of horrible to contemplate is that so have they been crushed and hidden that we can't find the part in them that's like us. We can't even project upon them. They don't want the culture as a whole does not want us to project upon them. So when I say that the Japanese are not going to publish The Commoner, it's because they don't want to touch it. Nothing like this has ever been written in modern Japanese history. The only thing, no novel about the imperial family at all, let alone by a guy who lives in Brooklyn. and the only thing that was ever written about it was one short story that was published in 1960 by a well-known Japanese writer. It was published in a literary journal. It was meant to be satirical. I don't know how funny it actually was. But it involved the narrator has a dream, and in the dream, members of the imperial family are all beheaded.
Mm.
Okay. Well, there was and continues to be a strong ultra-rightist faction in Japan, people who believe that either the emperor is still a god or ought to be, or ought to be treated like one. And every few years, these guys stab some poor newspaper editor who hasn't used the proper honorifics for the emperor. So back in 1960, after this story came out, one of these guys with a samurai sword broke into the house of the magazine publisher. He was out. They found his maid, killed her, and grievously wounded his wife.
Oh.
The publisher and the writer then went into exile, and the writer never published again.
Wow.
So this is just something to consider. I, of course, being American, think that this might be good for sales. So, you know, I'm wearing Kevlar, of course, but we'll see how it goes.
Wow. Oh, man. Do you think the role of women in Japan, though, how much do you think it has changed, especially since maybe when you were over there about 20 years ago or so?
Yeah. The role of women in a similar fashion, yes, it has changed some. I mean, the crown princess now, Masako Iwata, is prime example of how of somebody who would have continued to change.
Oh, I know.
It was thought that she would become the first female head of the foreign ministry.
And so many people were excited about that. And wasn't there even a drive or a movement to change the law so that women could also succeed?
There was until a year and a half ago. The crown prince now, Naruhito, actually has a younger brother, a figure who I left out of the book completely because I actually saw this coming. And to my mind, this wasn't the story that I wanted to tell. It didn't really deal with the story. But the crown prince's younger brother had two children, he and his wife, very early, two girls. They were all girls in the family. There were no boys whatsoever. They had claimed that they did not intend to have any more children. Years passed when the eldest prince did not have any more children and only had a girl. And the pressure mounted in the Japanese Diet, which is the parliament, in recent years to change the laws to allow the little girl, Aiko, to one day become empress.
Otherwise, the line would die out.
All the conservatives and the ultra-right faction were up in arms about this. And for whatever reasons, succumbing to pressure, succumbing to fraternal jealousy or whatever the case may be, suddenly the younger prince and his wife are pregnant again. Also probably through artificial means. I only mention this because it's just another thing that never gets discussed in Japan. And a year and a half ago, a boy is born finally to the family, thus ending all pressure on the Japanese Diet to change the laws and thus ensuring that all these women in this situation are frozen in their respective positions for the next 75 years and that nothing's going to change.
In the beginning of this book, you tell a story about two cranes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us the significance of the cranes.
Well, there are a number of stories in folklore, Japanese folklore, about cranes. I'm one of those people I'm a little wary about the symbolism in my own work. It's one of those things. There was a great Chilean writer named José Donoso who once said that he thought that a real novelist was someone who did not want to teach or to tell, but someone who wanted to know something. And I feel very strongly agree with that, in that things that usually get their way into my book because I want to know about them.
Mm-hmm.
And the cranes were an example. They emerge now in a prologue, and then they reemerge in a number of cases throughout the Empress's life, and they're a private symbol that she shares with her best friend. And they involve, obviously, flight. They involve escape, and they involve, in some level, some kind of destiny that somehow is not being lived out at the time. But in the beginning of the book, I mean, I did 7 drafts on this book, and one of the, you know, early on, that prologue was late in the book, and it was something that I came to, and I just sort of I wrote that little. It was like a folk. It was like a folk tale that I wrote. I made it up.
Oh, anyway, you made it up?
I did, and. Well, it's because you become steeped in the whole thing, and you know.
Oh, that's great. I like when I can't tell when it's made up.
Me too. That's my goal. That is my goal. So it then began to reappear, and I began to see it as something very important in the Empress's life.
Well, I saw also that you had a couple of little references in the book that actually went back to some of your other books. Like I noticed the name Kiko. Was it
Keiko?
Keiko,
yeah, from Bicycle Days.
Right,
yeah.
right. But Keiko in this novel is the new daughter-in-law, the young princess, who really probably had hoped that she'd be able to maintain her identity when she went in there.
You know, she said she hoped, but obviously, if she had really hoped, she would have accepted him a little sooner. She knew at some level. But she still, you still can't know. The only person who would have known for sure was the older woman who was already inside.
Right.
And there were rumors that in trying to persuade the crown princess to accept her son's proposal, the empress actually met with her privately and may even have promised protection of some kind. This is echoed in my book, obviously, but we'll never know.
And in 1993, even the Empress had another little nervous breakdown, didn't she?
Yeah. She suffered. I mean, she really has. I mean, however hard it is in the book, I think it's worse in real life, partly because, you know, I took the one of the perks of being a novelist is that you get to write your own ending.
Right.
And I did write my own ending. The book diverges quite radically from history at the end of this book, and partly because, you know, I think for an ending, if you're a novelist, what you're really looking for is an organic ending, something that seems to grow organically out of the story that you've just read and out of the characters' lives, what they've done and what they've thought. The more I looked into the actual history of this subject, the more unacceptable we won't call it an ending, but the situation as it now stands is, because there was nothing organic about it whatsoever. And the reason for that is that the imperial family in that tradition denies the human at every turn in the people inside, especially the people who have come from outside. Mm-hmm. The ones who are born into like the crown prince and the emperor, it's a little different. This is what they've known.
Right.
It's not a great situation, but it is what they've known. For the other ones, I just couldn't accept either humanly or narratively that this was the story as it is. It didn't seem to fit in, so I decided to take a little license.
Good for you.
And that's the end of the book.
I've been talking with John Burnham Schwartz about his latest book, The Commoner. Fascinating story. Thank you so much for allowing us to go between the lines with you today, John.
It's my pleasure.
To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Mike Johns. Technical producer, Ken Murray. Production assistant, Soo Young Jung. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.